Regular meeting of the Finance Committee, December 5th. It's 10 o'clock. I'll call this meeting to order, and let's get into some of these updates. Mark, is that up to you?
Okay, I'll lead off. So we have included in the packet these, just the two red items that have been in the bigger packet of about 80 items, just because nothing's happened with those other items. And we remain, I wouldn't say stumped, but there's a lot of effort that has to occur to dig to the bottom of this $123,000, unfortunately, even though it's, in my mind, pretty much budget dust and immaterial compared to the overall volume of the budget. But we have taken a look at this, and I should say this was kind of complicated by the fact that maybe a year ago, year and a half ago, when the audit was initiated, there was a decision to create a parallel general ledger that was used by the accounting, audit management preparation firm, the Poon Group. And so they made changes in a separate GL. We had RGL. And so it's unwinding all of that stuff that is kind of a big time commitment. And this week we had to sort of postpone activity on that because of the work on the committee, the other standing items in the committee, like the financial reporting. But we're hopeful that we can wrap it up within a week or two after we get through the committee activities. It's only $123,000, and it's really a matter of figuring out where it goes in terms of either revenue or expense or both or a combination of a variety of different journal entries that add up to that amount. So that's the status of the audit. The other task on here is the management discussion and analysis, and that's a document that we produce after the audit is finalized, and it basically is sort of a synopsis of the district's overall financial structure and operation here. So we'll get to that. Any questions on that or anything you want to add, Mark?
Yeah, I have a question. I don't know, Mimi, whether it's best for you or Mark with his CPA background. At some point, can we just say we can't figure out the $123,000? Stop spending time and energy on this. Get the audit report out, understanding we're going to take a hit from the auditor for the unaccounted $123,000.
So that's a great point, and I agree with you. And so I think we're getting to the point in the process where it's probably going to go down that road. We're going to make some final decisions on what we need to do, but this is also an opportunity because we're obviously going to take some lumps on this audit, right, as an organization. So this is an opportunity to get things as organized and cleaned up within that fiscal year as possible. And then we can start the next one, which is still 2 years behind, but we can start the next one at least at a lot better starting point, a lot cleaner, and then get through that year and then just keep building on that. And right now we're doing a lot of work, and hopefully you like the financial presentation that you're going to see a little bit later in today's meeting. We're also working right now on real-time operational data and financial reporting. And, you know, at some point here, it's all going to come together. So it is a good point to just get that audit done. I think it's an opportunity, though, to kind of get in there and clean up some stuff too.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, but I think this is the third month that this $123,000 figure has shown up.
Yeah,
And it's the only unresolved issue, really, except for the management letter afterwards. So I don't know, Martin, how do you feel about it? I'd like to recommend to the board, or do we give direction to let's end this? Let's get this audit done in whatever best information we can and move on to the next.
I would agree with that, unless there's some really low-hanging fruit in that 123 that you could cut it to 100 or something like that. But yeah, I don't care about taking lumps for $123,000.
And so I can talk to the auditors about that. When I had a conversation about the materiality of this about 3 or 4 months ago, they said, well, each of the funds has a different materiality threshold, and unfortunately, this exceeds it for all of them. They, of course, what we don't know is which fund this 123 is supposed to be in, but they were reluctant. But I think, you know, if the board is feeling that it's not worth it, I think we just take the hit. We've got, as Mark said, we've got 3 years since this fiscal year was there. There's pretty much nobody in the office who was still managing the money at that time. We mm-hmm. recognize that it was a little bit of a dumpster fire, and our goal is to, you know, clean up and move on. And so I can have another conversation with the auditors and see, you know, what it would take for that. They said they did not have enough money in their contract to go through and try to figure out where the $123K should have been posted to.
Well, and in prior discussions, everyone who has looked at this, and that includes a couple of consultants, professional staff here, nobody believes that somebody walked out the door with $123,000 in their pocket. If that were unresolved, I might have a different attitude. But since everybody is pretty well concerned that this is just bookkeeping inconsistencies and reporting error, like I said, I just think we just need to move on. And that's my recommendation. And it sounds like Director Pohl is in agreement, so I don't know if it needs to go to the board or if you can just do that on your own and with this committee's recommendation and move forward.
We have a call with the auditors on the 15th, and we can express that sentiment.
Is there any low-hanging fruit that, based on what you've done so far on this 123?
Not yet. I think there are some issues with the cash reconciliations on one or two accounts, mm-hmm. and you know, there's a process that we can go through to try to pin this down. And I've gone through situations similar to this before, not quite to this extent, but you know, number one is reconcile the balance sheet, and you have to balance in accounting. The debits and credits have to match, right? So, it, you know, provided that the opening balances are all good for the year, you know, then if you reconcile the balance sheet, everything else should just shake out through the P&L, right, through the income statement. So, you know, it's just a matter of going through that exercise, and that's something that we have underway right now. We have a call with the auditors on the 15th, and so I'm hoping that going through, making sure the balance sheet is fully reconciled and we have all the supporting documentation for that, then maybe this difference will shake out, or at least it'll shake out to the point that the auditors are satisfied and we can just easily move on to the next year. But I hear what you're saying, and I think it's a point well taken.
Okay.
I mean, if this were a receivable, at some point we'd write it off as a bad debt. I understand auditing isn't quite the same, but that's kind of where my mindset is.
Totally get it. Understood.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And do we have any public comments on this one? Or is that just from last time?
Comments. That's all from last time.
Shall I move on to the financial? Are we ready? Okay, so the conversation about the audit is actually a great segue to this topic, because this organization with 5 different enterprise funds and an administrative fund and restricted and unrestricted funds and reserves, it's a complex organization. And it was essentially undone during the last 4 years when there was a lack of understanding of the financial system and a lack of coding and cost assignments and revenue assignments. And so we have been focusing on rebuilding and correcting, but it's not all known yet, and it's going to take time to get a full understanding and a full rebuilding of the complex system. And so I present these financial reports with the caveat that we have a very a lengthy and large set of accounts, our chart of accounts. I think we discussed this last time about the existence of maybe 2,000 accounts in the chart of account, and we really only need about 500, or we're really only using about 500. But the consistency of usage, particularly in the payroll system, has some repercussions on some of the documents in some of the subdivisional expenses. And we had a conversation with staff that I referenced last time regarding the job costing and how the current payroll processing system was set up. And that was largely with the water enterprise activity as the primary umbrella for all operations staff. And so we are moving later this month to a new payroll processing company that is actually very responsive and also about $30,000 per year cheaper than the current one. And we have the opportunity to make corrections so that our costing of time and salaries is more in line with the realities. So that is going on. So I want to just, you know, lay that out there so you can see that. All right, so then to go into the budget to actual, we are looking at the end of November, which is 5 months of operation. And so the first page of this handout shows a very high-level overview, which ties into the Michael, do you need a copy?
Oh, no, it's okay.
Which ties into the budget that was presented in June. So that the far left column shows the revenues and the expenditures by enterprise fund, which are the five enterprise funds and administration. And then you have the budget of revenues projected at 10.9 and expenditures at 11.2 or 11.3 for a gap there of almost $300,000. If we move to the right, looking at the year-to-date total for the 5 months of activity and kind of prorating the revenues to date, we have $4.7 million and expended to date through November 30th, again, is 3.99, which shows a increase in net position of $730,000 for that time frame. And as a percentage of budget, the 5 months represents about 41.16%, and you can see the revenues are actually stronger. And this is a timing thing, so I wouldn't get too excited about it, but it's 43.1, so slightly higher. And then on the expenditures, slightly lower. So if it was 41.16, it's, you know, 35.5, almost 36. So 5% savings on the expenditures. And then you have the remaining budget numbers, which on the revenues we're looking at still receiving through the end of the fiscal year, $6.2 million, and then the expenditures based on the original budget at $7.2 million, which, so those are sort of the realities of the situation at the high level. I'm going to ask you to turn the page to go to the next presentation, which is both a deeper dive and also a transition from looking at the enterprise funds on the left to looking at more detail regarding the nature of the revenues and the nature of the expenses. So this presentation still includes the funds up across the top. So you have that same presentation of the 2023-2024 budget on the left, but this time it's broken out by the types of revenue and the types of expenditure, and then each of the funds' specific budgets, again, related to those categories of revenue and expense, are to the right, and there you go. And so just to walk us through this a little bit, you'll see the same numbers. You have a gap there of almost $300,000, in the aggregate, and then you can see kind of which of the funds are how they're doing from each of those. So revenue from admin is limited to the property tax, and then it's important to note that the administrative costs get reimbursed from those other funds, and that gets done later, towards the end of the fiscal year. So the costs for the five funds are not yet distributed to those funds. And then you have, you know, water, wastewater, drainage, solid waste, and security. And again, water is looking strong, but water is the largest revenue source for the organization, with residential fees being split across the five areas, but about 1/7 of it is really coming from water. So that's, I think, the reason for its strength in that. And we have not yet received all of our property taxes. Those come in stages throughout the year, so they are prorated on this to be just 5/12 of the overall expected property tax receipts. And then we've got some loan payments in there. I think what's most interesting is that we had a projection of about $45,000 in interest income, and as of now, we have $142,000 in interest income. And so we've been achieving some returns that are strong, and we've also got some plans to further increase those returns, which we'll talk about later. There's another set of documents that dive deeper. So each, so in the subsequent pages, you have one particular page for each fund. So admin, water, wastewater, and so that's sort of our new presentation. And we're open to comments and questions about that, either about the format or about the content.
I have a question.
Okay.
I'm on the second page,
okay.
And with regard to each fund, has, maybe you said this already, but I missed it, that has the administrative allocation been allocated to the funds?
That has not happened yet, and so that's typically an entry that happens here at the end of the year. But if that's something that you guys would like to see, we can do that on a periodic basis. So we're open to that. But that has not been done yet. And same with property tax revenue. That has not been allocated out either.
So that kind of skews that bottom line where it says results from operations. Those are, if you had those two things in there, these numbers would be different. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. Yes, so if we were to allocate that across, they would change.
So you can't tell right off the bat here whether or not any one of these funds is doing good or bad.
Well, I think that's a little subjective, right? I mean, you can look and see how they're doing on their own, right, without the admin overhead allocation. But you're 100% correct. If we were to allocate the administrative expenses, and then also don't forget the property tax revenue.
Yeah, that
across,
too.
Then it would change it.
Yeah, they should be closer to zero on most of them. If expenses are close to the budget, right? But
yeah.
If I look at that bottom line, I can't tell if they're doing good or bad, because our budget was based on allocations and mm-hmm. property tax allocations.
Okay. No, that's a fair point. So if going forward, would you prefer to see the administrative funds zeroed out and then everything in there allocated across the five enterprise funds? Is that a recommendation?
Well, I guess it depends on how hard it is to do that, right?
Yeah, I think it can be done for the purposes of this presentation and kind of mm-hmm. going from where we started mm-hmm. 30 days ago to where we're at today. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think this is a pretty good step forward. But if that's something that the committee is interested in seeing, then you know, there's definitely ways that we can work that in and make that happen.
So on that point, it seems to me under revenues, you have a category for other revenues. If you were to add as a revenue item the allocation collection, and then on your expense items, cite an allocation so that you would show the money going into the administrative budget mm-hmm. as a revenue item, and then would show as an expenditure for each of the other four enterprise funds, it seems to me that that would get to that zero sum that Martin's looking for. You'd have to prorate it, though, right, for each stage of the year, for each month to month?
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
But, I mean, so just for example, looking at security, we're showing a surplus on security of 11 grand. We all know that's not even close. I mean, by the time we get around to to the allocation. So
sure.
To Martin's point, I think that gives us a false picture. I agree. The other question I have with regard to security is it looks to me, if I follow the line across correctly, and maybe I'm looking at it the wrong line without a ruler here, it looks to me as though we're attributing $1,142 to connection and permit fees for security.
Go ahead. Do you have a response for that?
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe, if I remember correctly, with our connections for new meters, isn't there not a section that provides a certain percentage of funding for security?
Yes, I'm getting a nod from our accountant person. I actually don't know, but Chris, you're saying it does include a small, like a dollar? Like how much?
A little bit less than 1%. It's like
0.5% on connection fees. Okay.
0.5% of the fee?
Yeah, it's like 0.5%. It might be like 0.7%.
Okay.
Less than 1%.
All right. Thank you.
And if I could just weigh in on the administrative cost allocation, I think there are two things that I'd like to resolve before we do any distribution of the costs. And I shouldn't say two things. I'd say there is an overall objective on my part to keep our administrative costs down as much as possible. And then that shrinks the pool that then has to be allocated. And we have on our standing agenda for this committee the indirect cost rate. And we're going to talk about that later, but I want to just talk about it now because I think it's germane. I think it is possible for us to go back retroactively to the beginning of the year on the assignment of an indirect cost rate if we're able to come up with a methodology that takes into consideration other factors besides personnel for security. There are five funds, but really two just almost get a complete pass on the sharing of the costs, and that's trash or solid waste, which is contracted out, and I think that's why it's been super low at 2%. But there's still, you know, elements of work on that, and then also drainage, which was very low. And that makes the remaining three, even if they were divided equally, like 33%. And within those three areas, there are about 24 employees, roughly, 12 in security, roughly 12 in the other two areas. So that would put security at 50%, right, of the, if you looked at it just from personnel. And so that allocation is excessively burdensome for security, especially because security is not an enterprise activity that requires a lot of our administrative attention. They don't buy a lot of chemicals like Michael's shop. And Kelly actually always says, why does Michael get the ice cream, right? Because Michael's getting purchase orders, contracts, et cetera, because that activity requires a lot of attention. But security doesn't get the ice cream. They don't even get a shed, right? Their trailer has a tarp over it because it was leaking, you know. So they have been, they're sort of a low investment activity, you know, in terms of the administrative activities. So we want to reassess that indirect cost rate that was done, I think now 3 years ago, for something that more accurately conveys the demands on the administrative staff to assist the security operation. So those things, I agree that it's good to distribute the cost as we go so we can see it, or, you know, so you get a real picture in each of the funds. But I think given that we believe that the current indirect cost rate percentages are perhaps unfair to security or inconsistent in their, you know, percentage, given the amount of workload from admin, and I think that we can wait on that. I also like the ability to just see all the admin costs, and we could still present it, but it's good to see, okay, well, this is what's happening, especially as we work to narrow those down. I was reading the 1920 audit again over the weekend, and I was shocked at the reference to a 47% increase, $1.2 million, in admin between 1819 and 1920. So there was a really big jump in that time frame. And usually when indirect cost rates are established, they look at some of the historic data. And so that might have skewed the numbers as well. So anyway, that's just kind of my two cents on the whole indirect cost rate distribution.
And we've talked about that before, about the allocation. It's been challenged by members of the community in prior discussion. You know, obviously, wastewater drainage and solid waste and security, administrative costs just for collecting and processing the bills. I mean, there's some mm-hmm. allocation in order there, but as you say, a lot of the other purchasing, and I'm thinking about, you know, where we end up with litigation, where a lot of our IT work goes, mm-hmm. you know, so that all makes sense. So if it doesn't happen immediately, you know, I think we still need to get there where we're showing that allocation. But I agree, we ought to know what the allocation is going to be, and if we can restructure that to something that is more reasonable, more defensible, then that makes sense to me if we can accomplish that, you know, fairly soon.
I have another question on the same sheet about the last line in expenditures is capital improvements. I understand we have a capital improvement budget, I guess, but not all capital improvements are coming out of the operating. Not all the costs are coming out of the operating budget. Some are coming from elsewhere. So
that's correct. A different source, a different pot of money.
So adding that expense to the list kind of would skew it if it's not coming out of operating.
And the whole idea of including any capital improvements expense and revenue in the operating budget is sort of foreign to me.
It is to me.
And yeah. I think what we ought to do is, and this was established within 2 weeks of my arrival, and I didn't really mm-hmm. track on it. I didn't mm-hmm. really understand, you know, your budget as well as I do now. But after the last meeting, I was looking at the categories of revenues mm-hmm. and the categories of expenses, and I was baffled by the inclusion of the capital improvements, and actually dismayed, because that is not an expense that's hitting our operating general ledger in the same time. So it creates all these timing issues with regard to the money coming in and the money going out. So I think what I'd like to do for 24-25 is have two separate budgets, and because the capital improvement, as you say, it has many different potential sources of revenue. And I think that it just muddies the water to have it be included in the operating budget.
Because if you add all those expenses, even after you do those administrative allocations, you're going to still have a skewed result at the bottom.
Yeah, I just don't think it has a place in this budget. I think it should be a separate budget.
And we can't separate that report now because of the manner in which the budget was approved?
No.
No, I think we could. I think it's just I mean, I think we could do it. It's just we would have to, I think we could probably set it up in the GL with a separate code and have it be
farmed off. Because we still
have
7 more months in this fiscal year.
Yeah.
Well, 7 counting this month.
Yeah. I think we could pull it out and, you know, have it be a true operating budget and then a true capital improvement budget, and I think it would make it more clear. One of the things that we struggled with in looking at both the original budget and this data is that 23-24 budget had a list of the, I think it's $4.7 million worth of CIP projects, but no identification of sources of funds. And I think that was just sort of a quick and dirty, you know, kind of a need to get like what's needed out there. But I think now is a good opportunity to go back and say, look, these things realistically we can't afford this year. These are the ones that we can include in 23-24. These are the ones, like for example, the Granleys and or portions of the Granleys, the conversions from chlorine gas to bleach, and show the funding for those, right? So I think it'll be more informative.
I think it would also facilitate us once we get to the point that we know what our reserves are and where they are allocated to track that as well, because that would help us as a board in determining, do we have budget for this, or are we going to have to tap this fund's reserve? And so I think separating those and creating a capital budget and, you know, and looking at the reserves as part and parcel of that, I think makes a lot of sense.
I think the whole point of financial statements is to aid decision-making by those in governing positions and even stakeholders in private corporations. And so to the extent that, you know, the reports aren't doing that, then we have to adapt them so that they do meet the needs, so you can actually see. Because otherwise, like even in the last meeting, Martin said, well, Mimi, do we have the money, right? And it's like, yeah, that's the big question. That's the whole reason for doing audits and doing financial statements, to be able to know, you know, can you afford that, right?
And so, well, and to segue off of that, we approved expenditures for the purchase of membranes for the water treatment plant. Mm-hmm. Some of that may reasonably be operation costs, just regular maintenance and operation. Some of that may be capital because of the lifespan on those membranes. And so that may get a little complicated in the future, but I think those kinds of decisions by the board moving forward, or knowing, yeah, we've got this much in our maintenance budget, but we need this much more, so we got to call it capital. I think gets us to those points where Martin's question could have been answered.
Yes, exactly. And so we're still rebuilding. I do want to point out that we have the response to the is it a cat or a dog, essentially. Is it an operating expense or is it a capital improvement on the membranes? And we have a consensus between Mark and I, and probably Chris too, on the nature of the expense being operating. And that's because of a lot of, you know, GASB statements about how you treat these things, but essentially it's the lower dollar value per item, and then also the lack of the creation of additional capacity from the expense. So that
it's maintaining
it,
what you have, yep. It's not enhancing.
Yep, so that's dumping it into the OE
Makes
category.
Sense. Yep. Makes sense.
Okay.
One more?
Yep.
In revenues, we have reserve fees. Is that the $14 a month fee that gets in our bill?
Yes.
And it's two places, so it's really 20. Is it 28 total?
It's really 28.
Is that
yes,
right?
Correct. It's in water and in wastewater.
Okay. So I see the revenue coming in, but the intent is for that revenue to end up in a reserve account. So doesn't it need to come out?
Yeah, that's a very good point, right?
Because you're overinflating the revenue. And if you're trying to compare revenue and expenses.
Well, it's still, it's, I would say it's, I guess it's how you want to look at it, but I mean, I would say from an accounting standpoint, it's still revenue. It's just restricted for a certain use.
Right, but
yeah,
but with regard to the operating budget, it's coming out. It's not going to be included in the operating budget that we adopted.
So I think this is another good example of how these pieces that have been historically included, like the CIP and these two, that they need to come in, be seen, and then they need to be taken out and set it in a, you know, fenced off for the future reserve usage.
Yeah. I like the idea of seeing what we're bringing in.
Yeah.
But if you're going to look at any fund, it's skewing the revenue.
Yeah, because that is really not a set of resources that can be just used for salaries and other admin expenses, other operational expenses.
Right.
They're to be, so I think those need to be fenced off, and then the other things. But I think we can do a presentation where it shows it coming in, and then we show it going out. And those specific fund balances and the reserves, that's all part of that reconstruction process. So I'm going to show you some stuff later that gives you the overall finances. But what is missing on those is the background accounting of what is reserved where, what kind of reserves, what are the restricted, what's the unrestricted. And that's going to be coming into focus as we get the accounting system fine-tuned and operational with regard to all of the elements of it, because that's part of what got broken. But I think that's a very good point, that roughly $1.1 million has to be removed from consideration as part of the available resources for the operation of the district.
Okay. Steve, you have something
more? No, that's good. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So we don't have 22-23 yet, but because we've been primarily focused on the current year, but this framework that we're establishing will enable us to do the same thing with 22-23 once we get this one, you know, fine-tuned with all of these, you know, proposed changes that we've talked about, like the indirect cost allocation, the removal of the CIP from this budget, the removal of the restricted reserve fees for the water treatment plant debt and whatnot.
And essentially that's for our year end, for a fiscal year that ended June 30, right? I mean, that's how we would apply this tool to that year.
Yes. We would take it through, for that year, that's 22-23, so it would be the end of June 23.
Right.
And then we'd take all this same stuff and kind of build it back in. And so we'd do, you know, like hopefully three different, like, budgets, the operating budget for 22-23, mm-hmm. the CIP budget,
right.
and then the reserves.
Okay.
And then there's a broader reporting document that we would be creating here as soon as we get over this learning curve, and that is to have fund condition statements for each of these funds. So you have 100, but that's basically got to be zeroed out at the end of the year, and all those costs get distributed to the five. But for each of those five, we want to see the starting balance, the money in, and the money out, and then the balance. And so that'll be another report that we want to present so that you can see the condition of those funds, because that essentially, I think, is the reserve for those funds.
Oh, by the way, the title on this second page of the report says 22-23. You're going to fix that, right?
Oh, yes. Sorry about that. It's 23-24. Yep. Okay. And then included in this, in the materials for this item, is the check register report, which is usually shared at the board meeting, but we have it, so we included it in here, and we can answer any questions you have about this. This just represents the specific checks that were sent out for November, about $317,000. And we're happy to answer any questions about those.
Check
check 11639, Charlie Sue Back. Is that a reimbursement to someone?
I think that's a resident. Yeah, it looks like a fixture that probably was low flow that got a rebate for.
$11,644, a small amount, but to Old Republic Title?
That is probably a transfer of title escrow true up.
Again, I'm assuming Todd Smith is a resident with some sort of reimbursement?
Yeah, I think Todd Smith is a resident. Is that looking at Chris? It's a small amount, but yeah, I think that. Okay.
I mean, they're very small amounts, so I assume it's some
sort
of.
Is it like under
100? It's 107.
One was a little bigger than that.
So it's around maybe like 100 to 400?
Yeah.
Yeah. What was that first one? What are we paying Liebert Cassidy Whitmore for?
That is for the issue of PERS and a RA, a retired annuitant.
Oh, okay.
Issue. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I'm real familiar with the company, so I know what kind of work they do.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't have any other questions. Thank you.
Okay. Great. Okay. And then just on the financial reports, we also have capital outlay projects, budget to actuals as a standing item on the agenda. And again, that's under construction, right? Because there hasn't been any real good capturing of data on those, coding essentially. Okay, so then moving on to financial management policies and objectives, I've got two things in here, actually. I've got sort of a list of which financial institutions we have and how much money we have in them, and then also a district investment policy. So I think I want to start with the blue header on this, which shows the dollars sorted by balance, and then the green is sorted by return, percentage of return. And so on this, if you look up at the top, you can see the total funds are 16.3. And I just wanted to point out that of that amount, there are elements in there that, and so this is just a big high-level picture of all the resources in various institutions. And they're not identified by reserves or by fund or by restricted or unrestricted, because that's part of what has to be rebuilt. But in this list, you've got 16.3. Then within that 16.3, we know that there are some big chunks. So this is sort of a back of the napkin kind of assessment here, just to get us to some, you know, easy to understand framework of how much might be available. You have 16.3 million, which includes things we cannot touch, right? That either we're the agency for, or we were given that money for a specific thing which we have not yet done. And those items are pretty much three pieces. One is, and the biggest, is PARS, which is a investment company that handles our OPEB. And OPEB is basically other healthcare costs for retirees. So that's about $2.4 million of the resources presented here. Then there's $1.3 million that was given to us with a check from the 2021 state appropriation, and that is for a portion of those three improvements projects on Granley's Dam and the wastewater plant and the water treatment plant for conversion to a safer disinfectant, essentially. And then the
which one was that?
That one is it's integrated into either, well, it's probably El Dorado Save. It could be anywhere. It could be Lay for Camp, right? It's something that we received a long time ago, and it wasn't fenced off, essentially. So it was just deposited.
It must have been deposited to multiple locations based on the dollar amount.
No, it was deposited in a check to El Dorado Savings. So it's possible that it was actually expended, but we know the obligation exists, so we're kind of rebuilding the obligation, right? And then the third item is the CFD, which is the Special Assessment District, and that's all the Wilmington Trust elements. And that's about $732,000. And as I'm thinking about this, I could actually state that there's another $542,000 that could be or should be earmarked off, because we have that 12-month notification window that if an expansion of the treatment plan is required, we have to pony up the $542,000 that was used for change orders for the expansion initially. So if you take away everything, including that $540,000, what you really have is about $11.3 million. Okay? So then $11.3 million, if you project out what we anticipate to be the operating expense through the end of the year, which would be about 6.6, so 11.3 minus 6.6, you're looking at about a residual of about 4.8, not taking into consideration any monthly revenues, okay? So what that is just a real rough back of the napkin. Do we have enough to, you know, handle our needs? How much is, you know, earmarked? But we just don't have $16.3 million that we can use, right? But when we bring this back at a later date, when we have the reserve and restricted, unrestricted, all that accounting built into this money, it'll be clearer what you can touch and what you can't. Because that, I think, it goes back to that idea of financial systems or financial information being useful for decision making, right? To be able to know, well, you know, is there enough money to fix the Van Vleck tank, right? Or do we have to put it off to next year? That kind of thing. So this is just sort of a high level thing. Now, if we turn the page and go to the green version of this, same exact information, but it's sorted by the return on the money. So if you look at these, you'll see that we have a CD from Banner Bank that's paying us $575. That, and what I didn't put on there is that the term of that is 12 months. And Banner Bank is sort of an automatic repository for any of our credit card paid statements. And they also gave us a 5.5 rate on money market. Now, before that, Banner had been giving us basically zero. And if you look down the list further at El Dorado Savings, where we have three accounts, they basically have been giving us zero. And Wilmington Trust is at a good rate of about 5%. Again, that's for the CFD. There's a tiny chunk of money there, about $750,000. Then you have CAMP at 4.8. LAIF, where we have the bulk of our resources at $8.5 million, is at 3.15. And I think it might have gone up to 3.3, you know, in the last month, but that's essentially a small return relative to the dollars that are there and the percentages offered in other accounts. And then PARS down at the very bottom, that's a equity, and that at the point of this, which I may not have it be actually all the way through 11/30. It might be through September or something. But at that point, it was negative 2.57. So the returns dropped. So we have recommendations to be a little more aggressive about some of these things and maybe to find another manager of the PARS. They have expenses. And the PARS thing doesn't really affect the operating budget, except for the fact that if the OPEB doesn't perform and needs replenishment or assistance, it's going to come out of the operating budget. So it has this tangential impact. And so just in general, I think there's a need to make sure that we have security, of course, with these investments, but also returns. And it's been a strong market for the last 2 months. I think there was a plummet, and then it came back. But a lot of these institutions are offering fixed rates that are pretty strong. And so to that end, if we switch to the next page, which is the policy.
Before you do that, may I ask a question about PARS? Is that a dynamic account? So are we putting money in and also taking money out to pay benefits?
That's a very good question. So what has happened historically is that we made contributions to the PARS for the OPEB, and those contributions, we don't really know why, but they stopped in maybe 18, 19. There were no more contributions. So I think typically you'd be contributing and then also planning for growth, and those just stopped. So we're waiting on the actuaries who calculate what the OPEB obligation is. So those, if you remember, the GASB 75 data was not done in 19, 20, and 21, but that tells us what our unfunded obligation is. And so it was last done in 19, and it was around 50% unfunded.
And have we determined for whom these OPEB benefits are being set aside? Is it the entire workforce or just a percentage of the workforce?
All retirees.
Okay, so that's in addition to anything that a retiring employee might be eligible for under PERS?
Under PERS, yes.
In addition to. This is a separate medical benefit.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so we've stopped contributing to that 4 years ago?
They stopped contributing.
Right.
Yeah. And I think in addition.
Do we have a contractual obligation with the unionized employees for OPEB benefits?
We have an obligation to both represented and unrepresented employees for medical coverage at different levels. Yeah, based on. Yeah.
But for the unionized employees, is that memorialized in their contract?
Yes, and in a resolution by the board.
Okay.
From I think 2016 and forward, and then updated in 2019. So that is about 50%, but you know it's a timing thing because when they need it and a lot of different factors there. But basically, that would represent like a $2.4 million obligation at some point in time.
I see.
Yeah. Okay, so if we go to the policy, this policy was done in 2016, and I'm going to ask you to just turn the page on that to see Exhibit A. And Exhibit A, and excuse my handwritten notes on that, but I only had a PDF, and I didn't have time to change it all together. But there's a number one on the far left, kind of cut off there, and then a number two further down. And so what I want to recommend here is the addition of another sort of recently created investment pool that was authorized by government codes, but is specific for special districts and was done in conjunction with the CSDA. And so this one, the one that we've primarily been in is called LAIF, and LAIF adheres to these or is authorized by government code section 16429.1 through 4. And that outlines the whole governance structure of that that fund, the LAIF, which is local agency investment fund. That's LAIF, that's LAIF. And so this other investment pool that's recently been created is called CLASS, and it is established under government code section 53601, and it has been outperforming LAIF by about, I think, 2.2%. And so we would like the ability to deposit funds there, because with $8.2 million on deposit at LAIF at 2%, you're leaving a lot on the table. And to the extent that you don't earn money through the resources at your disposal, then you end up, you know, having to come up with money from another place. So we want to avoid that by investing this money in as much as we can. And sorry, I'm just going to calculate the 0.022 times 8,200,000 roughly. So that's about 180,000 a year more.
What did you say the rate for LAIF is?
LAIF, I have 3.15, and I think just it just ticked up to like 3.3. So I'm using 5.5 for class and 3.3 for LAIF.
Oh.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, 180,000 can go a long ways. That's a lot of membranes.
Love ice cream.
And ice cream. Yeah, it's a lot of ice cream.
No, we're cutting you off.
Just gonna complain.
So, if LAIF is
because you kept asking for sprinkles.
If LAIF is given 3.3, why is this class any better?
Why is class getting better?
Why is it any better?
I think LAIF is probably slow to respond to the market, and class is a little bit more aggressive. We had a meeting with the class managers, and they're just more focused on returns.
And how are those funds protected?
They're AAA funds, and they have they're not like a, you know, FDIC 110% collateralized product, but they, and I can't remember on this, Mark, did they say that there's a well,
they said that they meet the government code standards in California because they're a AAA rated investment.
Yeah, and I didn't bring my notes from that conversation, but the CSDA is the California Special Districts Association, and they work together to create this specific investment pool which has stronger returns through you know, more targeted investments. And they have this code section here, 53601, lays out the same language, and I know you can't rely on language, but it's the idea of those three pillars of investment that they require for governmental funds, which is safety of principal, liquidity, and return on investment. And so that gives us a lot of confidence in this pool. And just anecdotally, I was chatting with Andrew Ramos about this, and he said many districts are switching over to class.
What'd you say the rate was for them now?
It's variable too, but it was over 5.5 when we had our conversation with her.
As of yesterday, it was 5.75, and year to date, it's 5.15. So it's much higher than LAIF.
That's pretty good.
Yeah,
and it's not, you know, it's fully liquid. I think she said if we put in a request for the money by 10 a.m., we get it the next day.
Yeah, 10 a.m. you can have same day.
Oh, same day.
And after 10, next day. So it's the same liquidity, I think, that LAIF offers.
It's going to be hard to get it out of LAIF. They're going to hold up, give us grief, and say you can't do it.
Well, we've teed it all up with LAIF. I mean, you know, I should say, too, I feel a little bad that it's taken this long to get this information to you. But with all these different institutions, it has required so much paperwork and so much paperwork to authorize, you know, who the individuals are, and then also to get the online access and everything. So I'd say there's like 10 different accounts and all these. So anyway, it's been more trouble than I would have expected to come to this point. But now that we're at this point, we, you know, clearly see.
So what you want to do is bring this policy back to the board to be amended.
Correct.
And then we have the flexibility to use this additional account. And because it's a liquid account, if those returns drop dramatically, then we can switch it someplace else.
Yep. Yep.
Because it's a liquid account.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense to me.
Yep.
Especially if, and I just looked up the government code to see what that was about.
So you have a second part to this
So the second part is to allow a bigger percentage of CDs, because it's at 20%. And if you get a good rate in a CD, and the state treasurer requires any bank deposits, including CDs, to be collateralized at 110%. So that means that the bank has to have on deposit with the state treasurers, or make visible to them, 110% of whatever is on deposit with them. And that protects you from the insufficient coverage that an FDIC 250K per account would create. So that language dates back to, I think, 1978. I was thinking it came out of the Orange County bankruptcy, but I think it even predates that, where they are trying to make sure that local agencies are protected.
So does that mean you're going to buy only CDs up to 250?
No.
Individual ones.
It means whatever you have in a CD, it's covered beyond. It's covered at the full amount. Like you wouldn't have any risk.
Covered by?
By the 110% collateralization.
Well, but it's not covered by FDIC.
It would be covered by FDIC up to the 250, but then the banking institution has to place 110% of the value of your deposits with the state treasurer's office.
That's the downside of the CD, though, is if you're not covered by FDIC, because you got more than 250K in there.
So that's why the state treasurer for local agency monies, actually I think it's all state monies, any state monies that are in a bank, the financial institutions have to demonstrate 110% collateral on deposit with the state treasurer's office in order to give the local agencies more than the FDIC coverage of 250K.
Right now we have 18% of our total funds, based on the numbers up on that blue page, in a CD. So we haven't even hit our 20% threshold. Is it your intention then that we would increase the amount of our investment in CDs to take advantage of this higher return rate?
So my response to that would be that what you define as being monies that are our permitted investments, and the total of those probably is a factor in that. So if we said $16.2 million includes PARS and it includes Wilmington, which is CFD.
So then the $2.9 million in CD is $2.9 million of something more like $11 million, as you described earlier.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that's my sense. I mean, with accounting, you can slice and dice a lot of different ways, right? And so it matters that you define.
Negotiating union contracts, I learned to stretch the envelope as far as it would go sometimes.
So my sense is, just give us the capacity for 30, because I felt like we might be bumping up against it with the 2.9 million in there.
Well, what's interesting is if we're saying that only 11 million of that 16 million really is ours to do with what we want, mm-hmm. at 3 million, we're at 27%.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
All right. So 30% would give us covered on what we already have, and maybe a little wiggle room.
Yeah.
And just flexibility to take advantage of those higher returns.
Okay.
Yeah.
I see.
CDs are pretty safe investment vehicles.
You think you could get better than 5.75 right now?
That's pretty good for something as safe as a CD. Yeah, I don't think we can. I think that was a win to get that percentage.
And I think that I want to give Mark credit for that 5.75, because he negotiated it from somebody else that we were thinking about going with. And then I called up Banner to try to move the money out because they were giving us zero. And they said, well, why are you moving it? And I said, because you're giving us zero. And they said, well, what would it take for us to keep your business? And I said, 5.75. And they said, okay. And so I was like, thank you, Mark, for, planting that seed. And then that's for the CD. And then they said, well, what about the other cash? And I said 5.5, because that was another figure that had been thrown out there. So I'm going home and talking to my bank, you know.
I have a question about this list of financial institutions. What's the status of El Dorado?
El Dorado, well, you can see how little El Dorado gives us. And there's another issue with El Dorado, which is that, I'm sorry, what? Did you say something? Okay.
They were sold to Marin, weren't they?
They were bought, yes. And Chris, who bought them again?
El Dorado was bought by PacWest. PacWest was recently acquired by
Bank of California.
Yeah. That happened around the summer.
So, despite all these changes in its ownership, it remains sort of a sleepy financial institution that has not invested extensively in either automation or online systems. And so what you're looking at with that list of all the balances for those financial institutions, that's backed up by detail for each and every transaction over there so that we could do a reconciliation. And a lot of that information from the early years, like August 22, that had to be downloaded as a PDF. Mm-hmm. Because they didn't have CSV capacity, right? CSV is a comma-separated value. It's like in Excel, and you can pull data, and then you can use it in a ready format. Whereas with PDF, you're going to have to like copy and paste or rekey. And for some of our accounts, like our primary savings account, you're talking about hundreds of transactions per month, hundreds of checks. Well, not hundreds of checks, but 100 checks per month. And so it's burdensome. And we thought they had a scanner that could pull in all of our checks, and this is sort of a into the weeds, and you can stop me, but essentially we get about, I think, 2,000 checks a month, and those 2,000 checks have to be keyed in manually, and then the data from them gets used in different ways to be able to assess, what was paid and how we're doing and all that. But El Dorado said, "Oh no, we've got a scanner. We can make this work." And then we got the scanner. We're going through the training, and the trainer says, "Okay, before you can scan them, you have to individually key in the information into another system, and then into the system." And we were like, "What's the point?" So we're pursuing another financial institution that does have a scanner that converts the data automatically into an Excel-based thing. And that that paperwork is over there, and then we're hoping that this week that gets activated, and then we'll have to circle back with El Dorado.
So who are we going with?
Farmers and Merchants. Merchants.
There was another one.
We were considering another one. Yeah. Because we were considering also transitioning to a new CalCard credit card provider. Mm-hmm. But the U.S. bank said, "We also pay you a rebate of about 1%. And really, on the credit card usage, our historic use over, I think, 3 years was about $300,000. So 1% was only $3,000. So it's not a whole lot of money. And that bank ended up not being as competitive as Banner based on the hard-hitting negotiation techniques I learned from Mark.
So. Okay, that's great. Thank you.
Yep. Okay.
Okay, so then may I please, Mr. Cole, it is your wish to send this new policy to the board as well as Director Booth?
I'm in favor of Steve.
Yeah, the committee recommendation, right?
Okay, thank you very much. I'll have it on the next agenda.
Okay, and so that, going back to our agenda, is item 4. And then item 5, we don't really have much additional information on this, but we did convey last time that we think that Great Plains is effective. And, in fact, a lot of the revenue information off of Tyler Billing, I'm sorry, I'm kind of getting confused on that. So Tyler Technologies was originally anticipated for two primary activities. One was utility billing and the other was the financials. And so Tyler billing was done first, and that went live in April. And it's fine. And Mark and Chris were able to pull out information. And there's a lot of very granular information on the billing, which, you know, there's at least the five enterprise activities, and then there's often little sub pieces, including those two, the $14 and the $6. So there's all these different components. So all that information has to be brought in that framework, and Tyler's doing a good job of that. But we don't really see the need to move into Tyler Technologies for a new financial system because there's capacity in Great Plains. So we're still confident that that's a good path. Any questions about the financial accounting system analysis?
Have you talked to any other vendors?
No, because where we're at right now is like under $5,000 a year for Great Plains, mm-hmm. And so it's kind of doing the job. We actually have been scheduled for monthly meetings with sort of an advisor or a trainer on Great Plains, and she had to cancel this week. But in our conversation about a month ago, she made us all start to think about the possibility of even doing our billing directly through Great Plains. And that, you know, could present some advantage as well. Because in any accounting system, to the extent that you have to, you know, rekey or reconnect any of these information systems to each other, you have the potential for error. And so if our billing system was part of Great Plains, it would be operationally very, very clean. So that is one area that we're going to be exploring in the next couple of months as we work with her to see about that capacity. And Mark, I don't know if you want to weigh in on that and say anything more about, I think we're still learning. But we think there's potential there.
No, and I totally agree with that. And not only would it be more efficient and seamless in the posting of the transactions, but it would be more cost-effective to have a one-stop-shop solution. So, and I believe Great Plains is much more cost-effective than the Tyler General Ledger package. So that's why we're trying to make Great Plains. We're trying to see and finish evaluating and make sure that it's a viable working option, it appears to be.
Okay.
Okay. And then the last item is our District 24-25 budget, which we're targeting end of February, early March. And two pieces that are going to be key to that are this revamped indirect cost rate. So that's also on our agenda, you know, to... not on our agenda, excuse me. It's on our to-do list of trying to figure out like how to make that be a more accurate assessment of the burdens that each fund should get. And then on the service rates, you know, what those should be. And we don't think that we'll be ready with the rate study anytime before the 24-25, but we do think it's realistic that there would be some kind of increase, and our hope is to keep it in the under 10% range. And you can see that there's a need just by looking at the revenues and the expenses and the gap of $300,000. But I think after we pull off the CIPs and pull off the restricted, we'll have a better sense of what the true gap is. And then, of course, as we get through the audits. But we're in the process right now of aggregating multi-year increases, or actually just multi-year rates from regional water providers, just to be able to see how we are comparing in terms of our rates and our approach to cost effectiveness. And just along those lines, too, I would say that, you know, we're doing what we can to decrease unnecessary costs. We are switching over to a new Paychex provider that'll be $30,000 less per year. We removed a storage container that had about 120 banker's boxes of very old information on AP, AR, and payroll, and you know, any pretty much any aspect of the operation that is draining money that we think could be done without whatever that expenditure is, we're looking at, in order to try to avoid any kind of rate increases. So there is a commitment to living within our means, but there's also a recognition that we have to keep moving forward with certain improvements just for overall reliability of the systems. So,
yeah, and I think that's going to be a key for our discussion. I applaud your efforts to reduce expenditures and increase efficiencies. You know, a couple of months in a row now, if trends hold, we're projecting a modest surplus, despite the fact that this budget was approved with in the red. So that's quite a turnaround. If we zero out, that's a win from my perspective.
Well, how do you know we're making a profit?
We've had projections now from our accounting reports based on year-to-date figures. If those trends hold, then we're projecting that our expenditures would be less than our budgeted amounts.
I haven't seen that.
Well, I think Director Booth is referencing the 723, the 723K in that column that shows the balance.
That'll fluctuate. Yeah. And I'm saying that very cautiously. I mean, President Mabee made a comment, and that was picked up in the newspaper, and a lot of people in the community were talking about, you know, if you're projecting a surplus, then why aren't you doing this, this, and this? So if those hold, everything we can do to live within means, the CPI through October without seasonal adjustment was 3.2%. So fortunately, inflation has leveled off, stabilized a little bit from what it was 2 years ago, in particular, the year that we did not get a rate increase. I think those are really, we got to look at all those factors going into that discussion in March, and going to need a really strong projection for year end so that we can focus more discussion on building our reserves.
I think the reserves ought to be on the table for this budget.
I think they should too. Reserve increases. I think they should be too.
Yeah. And that's if we don't have the study from, was it Lumos? Is it
Lumos?
Yeah. That's who's doing it for us. But it's not. The timing won't be right.
We'll have a capital improvements program to look at, but we won't have our starting balances correct.
Vendor contractor who is doing the capital improvement program study would also be doing the rate study, but they have they want to see the audits, excuse me, for 21, 22, 22, 23, 23, 24, so they know how much we have. Mm-hmm. And in order to compare that to the CIP, in order to be able to say, well, this is the gap, hence you need to have an increase or you don't. And so we were talking about that, and we thought, well, we're not going to get that information probably until Christmas of 24, because you got three audits that have to get done.
We were supposed to have two of them done by this month.
Yeah. So there's a lot of uncertainty with that, but we can realistically determine that there needs to be some level of increase, and my goal is to keep it minimal, right?
Even if the reserve increase is modest or minor, still, we didn't do anything last year, and we didn't do anything the previous year.
Well, and you know, we've talked in this chamber about the report from the grand jury, and as I said more than once, you know, they're saying we think we have approximately $10 million in reserve and we ought to have $20 million. I don't know where that number came from, and that's why the Lumos study is so important to us, I think, so that we actually have a target that we can talk about. I will tell you, as a non-member of the board, citizen contemplating the rate increases a couple of years ago, and being told when I asked questions, we were trying to build the reserve and build it for what, quantifying it was really difficult. And we're still struggling with that a little bit. We have a good idea of some of the capital improvement projects that are needed short term. Again, we're making progress towards all of these goals. I just wish that they were happening faster, which is probably why I suggested earlier, let's write off that 123 grand and move to the next one. Because we were told last late winter, spring, we would probably have the 21-22 audit by this month.
Yeah.
And we don't even have the earlier one yet. For obviously a variety of reasons, but I think we need to figure out how to get those done.
The other thing I think ought to be on the table is the security budget with regard to Measure J. We subsidize it this year. That subsidy seems to me wants to go down. Unless you're...
Say that last part again.
The subsidy wants to go down, I think.
That was the original plan when we did 23-24, rather than have a complete elimination of the 500 over, roughly. We said, okay, a reduction of 250,000 in 23-24 and then another 250 in 24-25. But we do have a 2% increase.
Mimi, I've heard you say that a couple of times and I'm confused because I just looked at our budget.
Mm-hmm.
And our budget only authorized $50,000 to go to security.
It started that way, but it didn't end up that way.
It did. I think that happened in March, the 50K mm-hmm. augmentation or the 50K, commitment of the property tax funds. But when I was here in June, I argued that it was, when we were talking about the 23-24 budget, I argued that it would be very difficult to take away 500,000 all in one fell swoop from security on July 1st because of the employees that we had, and that it's difficult to just, so I proposed a ramp down of 250K reduction in 23-24 with the next 250 coming in July 1st of 24. Yeah.
So that additional 200,000, I looked for the budget, maybe I looked at the wrong version over this last week. That just about accounts for the budget decrease in net position. It's most of that 282.
Which position?
On your second page of the packet here, we have the budget revenues versus expenditures and the decrease in net position at 282,630.
282,630. Yes, on
200,000 more going to security in this year's budget accounts for 2/3 of that.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, it's oversimplistic.
Yeah. But. I mean, like you could say that again, recognizing that as the budget was prepared and as the expenses were prepared, it included CIP, and it also included the reserve amounts, and so all those things. But yeah, the gap there is about 250K.
So, Martin, your recollection is that the final budget actually authorized $250,000 to security.
We started. Our committee said 50 grand.
Yeah.
By the time it got to the end, it wasn't feasible with regard to the personnel.
It should be in the minutes or the audio.
Sure it is. I lost track of it.
Yeah.
Because again, I'm having some dialogue with some people in the community about security and specifically the comment that Tim made about the potentially projected surplus, and I think it was Ms. Matter that immediately said, well, then why aren't you dedicating that to security? So I went back to look at the security budget because I heard your comment and I didn't recall us approving that 250.
Were you at the June meeting? Because I feel like there was
a meeting that you were out of country
or something.
So that's, but again, maybe I just looked at the wrong version of the budget
in
my records.
And I can't recall too. I know I suggested a ramp down, half of the reduction in 23-24, the remainder in 24-25. But I also, I don't know if I made that recommendation in the course of the conversation at the meeting. And so if the paperwork was, the original projection or whatever, because Susan did the budget and then I was like 2 weeks in, and I recommended a softer landing for that team.
Yeah. I may have pulled up a copy out of my own records as opposed to the district website, so I'll go back and look
okay.
at that. Thank you.
Can I send you the link to the website?
Sure.
Let me do that.
But what I'm saying is that, you know, the official paperwork on there might have been, you know, saved from the, you know, a version where she brought to the committee or to the board the 50K, and then I said, well, let's do this. Because right. I also said at that same time, let's not buy a new security trailer. Let's give all the ice cream to Michael.
Right.
I didn't say that. But I said, I don't know that we have 250K to buy a new security trailer, so let's hold off. And that, I think,
Michael,
you still see.
Michael, you realize Kelly is armed.
Yeah, but you don't want to throw good money after bad.
Yeah, I'll look at that final budget. I apparently didn't look at the right version. Thank you.
Yeah.
Because everybody can't afford the bullets.
Well, that's true.
That's right.
And that's about all I have, but we're available for questions.
No, there's more items on the backside.
Are there really?
Yes.
Oh, yes. I'm so sorry. Yeah. Mine's on two different pages, and I just missed it. Okay. And so this is the letter from Brad Beer. And what I have for that is just an apology, really. It came in to me on June 5th, I think, when we were doing the budget on June 7th. And I had a preliminary conversation with Andrew and Michael about the components of the rate for the airport, which included square footage and additional square footage over years, and then the sequence of 2% increases per year and the rates. And we had some spreadsheet that was partial, and somebody else had done it, and I said, well, I'll take responsibility and go in there and look at that. And really, it's just been like an avalanche of information coming at me for 7 months, and I've had it on my desk and just, you know, didn't get to it. So I apologized to him, and I committed to going back and doing that analysis and responding to him by this Friday. So that's where we're at with that one.
So if I remember correctly from reading his communication, he's alleging that he's being charged about twice what his bill should be.
It would be speculation on my part because I haven't done the analysis yet. Okay. All I have is this, okay,
no, but that, it was his allegation.
Frame.
The $2 amounts that he provided said, hey, you charged me this, I think I only owe this.
Yeah.
If I recall the correspondence correctly.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
we will have an answer to him hopefully by this Friday?
Yes.
Okay. And then Thursday at the communications committee, as you know, I've asked, I want to talk about how we receive, track, and respond to
Absolutely.
Correspondence. I think that
yeah.
there's a need for a business practice in that regard. It is one of
Yeah.
the frequent complaints that we hear. And I'll hold further discussion until the Thursday Communications Committee. But that's why I asked to have this here. I was hoping we might have an answer to whether or not the airport was being overcharged.
Yeah, the documentation for this committee meeting has taken up a lot of my time and since that letter came
okay.
in. And so he didn't get... I didn't have any free time to be able to devote to his questions. And then just regarding tracking of questions, we have a database for the PRA requests, and we're going to do a similar kind of thing for that. My long-term goal is to have electronic submission of invoices, and that'll help us to track those. There are a whole lot of paper things that just are at the mercy of, you know, a clean desk, clean mind, whatever, and we just need a tracking system for virtually everything that's coming in like that,
and
we'll
like
do
I
that.
Like I said, I have some ideas and some rationale to discuss at Thursday's meeting.
Great.
Okay.
And I do have a public comment, if you're accepting public comments now.
Yep, that's the right time.
Would
you? Do it.
I was expecting to see that letter in the packet. Is that going to be made available?
Oh, the letter from
Brad Beer.
It's because you wrote it to the whole board, so it will be included in
the board packet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not the packet for today?
Well, we can stick it
I
in
think
this packet.
I'd like to
I
see
have
it.
The letter.
Yeah. We can stick it in.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else from
No other public
Mark?
Comments.
We haven't heard from Michael. I don't know why he doesn't want to talk. You want to talk?
He's too busy eating ice cream.
Yeah, no, I look. This is great progress, and you know, I really appreciate the efforts that Mimi and Mark have done to get us to this point. It's been long coming.
Thank you.
Steve, you got anything to add?
No, thank you. Okay. I have plenty of opportunity to express myself today.
I don't have anything else to add, so we're adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.